Okay, welcome everyone. Akasha here, Nan Akasha from nanakasha.com, and welcome to the Bliss Life Podcast Global Healing Series. So this is another one of our conversations on energy medicine. And as you know, I'm an energy girl. I've studied many modalities over about 35 years. And today I get to share with you somebody who's personally helped me and my partner, Chris, as well as been doing just his own really awesome thing for longer than that, for 36 years. So welcome, John.
Well, hi, Nan. It's great to see you again. And I just found out that you and Chris now live in Mexico. That's exciting for you guys. And right now, because of the COVID lockdown, I normally live in Paris, but we are residing in place here in Morocco, in Marrakech. So we've been here for 6 weeks. So it's a interesting time to be in Marrakech.
No kidding. I know. It's so beautiful, too, where you're sitting. Oh, so, okay. So John has been all kinds of things, right? A chiropractor, you've led sweat lodges, taught Tai Chi, been a massage therapist, and an acupuncturist as well, and Sufi. I really want to hear about that, teaching some Sufi. And then for 35 years now, you have been doing your karma work as well. So share with us how you were just saying that you were born with a gift and how this, your life and all of your experiences has led to this fascinating work that you do.
Yeah, thanks. I was born with real kind of bizarre looking retinas. They look like pavement stones. And I think it gave me some visual problems a little bit. Things look a little different to me. But then when I was 14, I started meditating with a vengeance, like 2 or 3 hours a day. And so that kind of exploded, kind of awakened my third eye. And I didn't know what I was doing at first, but sooner I got more insight into what was happening to me. So I was having kind of a spiritual awakening. So the time I was 18, I went away to college and I started doing aura readings, $5 or lunch, which wasn't bad in 1969. It was pretty decent. And this continued to inspire me to get into alternative healing. So I started doing massage, and then I went to chiropractic college and studied acupuncture because I could see where to put the needles in and stuff. And I enjoyed all that very much. But then it was 1984, really right before Thanksgiving in 1984, this young guy came in. Well, he's like 27 years old, and his low back was terribly worn out already. He was a ditch digger for the city of Tulsa, and he was quite tall. He was like, 6'5" or something, you know, and he had a brown haze in his aura. And I said, I always see this on people that have bad jobs, bad pay, bad bosses. Like, what is this like? Slave, brown, or what, you know? So I decided to do a muscle test, since I was just trying to kill a little time while I was having the acupuncture take effect and stuff. And I said, raise your arm here. And I said, is this person carrying the energy of slavery? And his arm went right down. And then he about jumped off the table. I said, you can't do that. You got needles in you. You know, I said, he said, I used to have these terrible dreams, these night terrors when I was a child about being a slave. And I'm trying to run away and I get caught every time and they start whipping me. I wake up screaming. So that was like, just, I was in shock from just hearing that. And so he went on about his dreams for about 5 minutes. I said, damn, looks like a bad case of post-traumatic slave lifetime syndrome. I was sort of trying to offer a little levity to the situation. He said, that's definitely the diagnosis, doc. And then he said, is there any like chiropractic adjustment that can straighten out bad karma? I said, oh, no, I'm sorry. I mean, you know, it takes a long time to get rid of bad karma. And some people say you never get rid of it. You just have to pay it off. And there's all these different ideas on it. But I think that, you know, the way to get rid of bad karma is you have to quiet this special layer of your aura that I call the light body. It's this deep layer. And if you quiet that enough, then you stop emanating the bad karmas into existence. And that usually takes 20, 30 years of full-time meditation, a good teacher, a lot of luck. And as Buddha said, some become enlightened and some don't. You know, so he said that wasn't probably going to work for him. He couldn't even kneel for mass anymore. He was Irish Catholic, and he dropped out of high school to marry his sweetheart and got pregnant. And he was a wonderful father and a wonderful man, had a wonderful wife and wonderful little kids, you know. But he was kind of stuck in this slave type pattern. And so he said, well, you know, is there a, how does the karma get here? I said, well, when we're born, our light body, which is kind of like the clothes of the soul, merges with our little baby body, and it carries with it some of the beauty of other lives, some of the skills of other lives, some of the traumas, some of the scars. And the light body, and the research has been done by this guy named Ian Stevenson. He was a full professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, where he interviewed young children who had, you know, memories of past lives. They usually come in between the ages of like 4 and 8. But it seems that the karma shapes your physical body to some degree, your character, your personality. It's quite interesting. And your destiny. And so essentially, it's much different than your energy body. Like your energy body, if you want to fix that, you know, 3 meals a day, good night's sleep, low stress lifestyle, exercise, runs like a top. If you want to fix your emotional aura, 3 meals a day, good night's sleep, low stress life, you know, go to the counseling. Maybe some people have to take pills because they have bad brain chemistry, you know. And then there's your mental aura, which also responds really well to 3 meals a day, good night's sleep, et cetera. And we can change our mental aura immediately. If I say make a plan for tomorrow, well, your mental aura usually turns yellow, which is the kind of the color of executive functioning, though it's suspiciously similar to the same color as fear. So it's kind of like the agitated mind, you know. I want to talk more about fear in a little bit. Then there's the blue part of the mental aura, which is about grooving on the now, like dancing or surfing or singing or making love or, you know, what me worry, life's a ride, life's beautiful. And then if you want to change your emotional aura, well, just say, be happy for 5 minutes. And most of us could come up with that for 5 minutes or so before we start to degrade. And then turn your aura sort of pink or yellow pink or, you know, different colors for different people, of course. Or if I said, you know, send energy to your hands, we could measure that on a galvanic skin response. But if I say, make your light body light up like a candle, almost nobody can do it because we don't have volitional control of our light body. Now, the good news of this is, and it is good news, is that we wake up relatively the same person every day. It would be really bad if we woke up a different person every day. You see what I'm saying? So that's the good news, okay? The bad news is we wake up the same damn person every day with the same shit hitting the same fan and the same problems and the same repeating patterns that seem to grind us down. So I figured out basically a way to de-traumatize the light body. And that's what I did on him. People would come to me for chiropractic and they were terrified. They had the car accident like yesterday or something. And so I did this kind of Ericksonian kind of spiritual hypnosis technique on them to try to get their reptile brain to smooth out so that they wouldn't just walk around like this all the time, and they would relax enough to let me adjust them. And so I decided to kill some time on this guy and said, well, let me try to de-traumatize you from, you know, the slave karma. And the reason I thought of that, he said, well, is this some sort of punishment? Was I a terrible slave master in another life, and now I have to pay the price and be a slave life after life? Was I a horrible person, you know? I think that maybe a little bit of Irish Catholic training in there, you know, could have been bigger than that, you know? So I said, well, you know, I believe most bad karma is really bad trauma. And I do know that. I said, to me, you look like you haven't done any, try to never do harm to anyone. You don't have an ill bone in your body. He was quite a good-hearted fellow. So he liked that idea. He was relieved to know that perhaps he hadn't been a horrible person. And anyway, I was just sort of killing some time, and I really didn't have any hope that I could change his light body that fast. He asked me, well, is there any way to change the light body really quickly? I said, well, bad trauma. You know, those boys that go off to war and come back, they're light bodies. You know, they don't recover very much. So usually, he said, is there any way to change it besides meditation? Well, I said, you know, if you master something, we're kind of like a garden. If you grow flowers and vegetables, then the weeds don't have much room, you know? So if you, you know, do, you know, creative writing or singing or master some musical thing or do dancing all the time, if you do plant all those flowers, then the weeds don't have much room to grow, but it still takes a long time to imprint the light body, you know? So he said, is there any fast way to change it? I said, well, as I said, you know, bad trauma. Is there any fast way to change it in a good way? I said, well, you know, interestingly, some people have had near-death experiences. And when they have that near-death experience, sometimes that changes their light body in a really good way, you know? So I'd had this guy come to me for 3 months. He was some sort of drug dealer kind of guy or something like that. And then he got well. And then I saw him a year later and he'd had this, another car accident. His back was all jacked up, but he was a completely different person. I said, I'm going to school. I'm going to be a psychologist. I've stopped dealing drugs. You know, everything had changed, you know? So sometimes, but of course you can't do a near-death experience as a technique. You'll kill yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't recommend it.
Yeah, don't drink no Clorox either. So so the nature of the light body is it doesn't usually change very quickly. Now, I have known people to be able to change their light body. I teach meditation, have a Sufi type meditation classes and stuff. I've done that since 1975, so that's a long time now. I'm hideously old. But what it comes down to is, I see this woman in the spring who was a student of mine, and I see her in the fall. I notice, boy, your light body really changed. What did you do over the summer? And I said, did you do like 40 days of meditation or something? It looks like you really, you know, so smooth. Her whole aura had been jagged ever since I'd known her, and it was so smoothed out. And she had taken her son and 9 other Eagle Scout boy scouts to the boundary waters between the United States and Canada. And they just were in nature for 3 weeks. They didn't see anybody else, and just her and the boys and the campfire and the swimming and the sun and the stars. And so I think it's kind of like the outward bound theory, but it's less contrived than that. It's if full immersion in nature, a pilgrimage, a quest, those things can also help us sometimes. Sometimes there's no guarantees. But anyway, I just this experimental thing where I tried to do this sort of spiritual hypnosis to de-traumatize something very much like, you know, the slavery's over now, all the terrible conditions, the poverty, the abuse, the mistreatment, the long, horrible, laborious hours have ended. I'm ready for a new life, a life of abundance, a life of self-employment. I'm willing to take full responsibility for my work existence and to create a new profession for myself. I'm willing to get all the help and training I need to move forward. And I just kind of went on in that vein for 3 or 4 minutes while holding his temples and talking to him and just talking to his soul, basically, you know. Yeah. And at the end of it, I wasn't expecting much, but he looked like completely better. And I thought, this is outrageous. You know, nobody gets better that fast from this, you know. And so I dismissed it. I have this thing I call the Weyrich Law of Delusion. If there's any way you can delude yourself, you will. I mean, our species is unfortunately very, very prone to delusion.
Yes.
So his whole life changed. Within 6 months, he had his own contractor's license with his cousin. He was self-employed, making like 10 times more money. So I started doing this work on everybody. And after a couple of years, it replaced my chiropractic practice. Best count now, I've done, you know, over 20,000 sessions. It's really outrageous. I can't believe I've done that much work. But I have been doing it for 36 years here. So, you know, it's like,
And it's such a fascinating topic. I love it. As a hypnotherapist, I combine it with shamanic journeying and energy work. But you realize that exactly what you're talking about, all of these agreements, all of these situations, we bring some of them with us. And I wasn't even sure I believed in past lives when I got on my spiritual path. It seemed too good to be true. And I've done hypnosis and sessions with people who don't believe in it. And then they go, oh, but I just experienced a past life and it was so vivid and so real to me that I know, and they change because they remember, because they realize, and they, and then we see the agreement that was made that becomes like, I see it as an energetic attachment or a karmic knot, I call it. And then that can affect, you know, this life. And then, like you said, create so many things in your life. So you really touched on the crux of, for most people. In fact, it's so funny. You said, he asked you, am I being punished? You know, did I do something wrong? I just finished a healing session where we do all this before this interview. And that was his underlying agreement that we discovered was life is a punishment. It's not safe to be in a body, and, you know, I'm never good enough and all these kinds of things. And so it's definitely on on the plate for everybody and for the planet too, in this cleanse. So, well, we're going to talk about, you're going to talk about the alchemy of transforming fear and dark fantasies. So in the fear can be about survival, or it could be about being good enough, right? It could be about many, many different things. In that area.
So let me, what I did, I started to break down what is fear, what really is fear. And what I realized is that fear is, it makes your mouth dry. It makes you contract. It makes you pull away. It makes you cold. Your hands and feet get cold. So fear is dry, cold, and contracting. And that's some of the alchemical qualities of it. Whereas awe, look at that sunrise. Oh, look at that beautiful flower, is warm, moist, and expansive. So I read this thing. There's a word in the Bible, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Well, you know, the word isn't fear. That's a bad translation. It's awe. It's reverence, it's awe. And so that fundamental understanding changed a lot for me. I realized that when people are in fear, they contract their aura, they pull away. And so the idea is, what is warm, moist, and expansive? Love, awe, curiosity is mental expansion and warmth and your interest, you see? So if you stay in a place of curiosity, if you stay in a place of awe, if you stay in a place of wonder. So really it's all about how do you, like this is a wondrous time, a time of extraordinary wonder, a time of beauty, a time of awe. We should all feel awe, in awe of what's happening. The machinery of our civilization is grinding to a halt. We should all be in awe. And so, if you take the fallow field and you plow it and you expand it, and then you moisten it with rain and you warm it with the sun, it becomes warm, moist, and expansive. And that's right. Sex is warm, moist, and expansive. Now, even take grief, like a lot of people are having grief. Grief is a little hollow, it's a little dry, it's a little cold, it's a little contracting. I want to be alone, I just want to, But mourning is crying, is warm, moist, and expansive. So the cure for grief is to cry, to mourn. It's a natural thing, you see. So I just wanted to explain that. And so there's a, in Sufism, there's a special condition called calendar. And calendar, the word calendar came from calendar, and it means moments. And somebody who's in a state of calendar is in a state of continuous awe or continuous bewilderment or continuous delight. And delight is warm, moist, and expansive, you see. And so what tends to happen is people begin to start to tell a story. They contract into a story about what's going on. They're, you know, we don't know what will happen. This is, but our mind is desperate to try to figure out what will happen. Will I live? Will I die? Will I get this terrible disease? Will I not? Will the people I love get it and die? Will I be able to make money? Will I not? You know, and our mind is restless and trying to solve the problem with, and none of us have enough information. None of us know what will happen. But it's this uncertainty. So uncertainty is a good ground for wonder. It's a good ground base for awe. It's a good ground base for desire, for the yearning and desire. You know, what do you want to happen? So we need to take refuge in our desire, in our wonder, in our curiosity, and not contract into the story about what could happen, you see. So many years ago, I went to this woman's house, and she was a lovely woman, but she had a really pretty awful aura. And she was 42, and she was Italian, and she was living in LA, and she had a huge house, like 8,500 square feet, you know, that's big. Yeah. It was a mansion, you know? And she had five kids, four sons and a young three-year-old daughter. And so I talked to her a little bit and realized that she was actually in a terrible situation. So when she was 19, she went on the third date with this very handsome law student guy that wasn't even really her boyfriend yet. And he raped her and got her pregnant. And that his family was rich and her family was well known, and they fathers decided they got married. So 2 months later, she was married to her rapist, right? Oh, and he grew up to become a very charismatic but alcoholic and abusive drug lord defense lawyer kind of guy. Not saying that drug divorce defense lawyers are bad, but you know, kind of following in his father's firm, and it was a little mafioso actually. But you know, she was miserable. And you know, she just got pregnant again because she had joy in her children, and she got pregnant again and all that. And I said, unfortunately, you have this very difficult karma. That's the call to prayer. Unfortunately, have this very difficult karma of being a failed protective mother. You're not protecting your children, and the universe doesn't go along with that in a good way. And also, you're not protecting yourself. And she said something that broke my heart a bit. She said, look, every time I talk like I want divorce, you know, which I was suggesting, he says, I'm going to have you committed. Yeah, there's the hospital, you know, that he was going to have her, because she had been on meds for years and she was a nervous wreck and everything, you know. And she said, look, he only beats me twice a year. I can take it. And I just sunk, you know, when you hear that, like, so what happened is I had this little vision, like if somebody locks you in a closet and you can't get out, the first thing you do after a point, you start getting thirsty and maybe hungry. So you look around, is there anything to eat or drink? The first thing we do is we use the intelligence of our desire to look for something desirable. We don't sit there and chew on a stick, you know, we want to see if there's some old water or soda or something to drink or something to eat, a jar of peanut butter or something. The second thing we do after we find there's nothing to eat is we go into a fantasy. We fantasize about what we would want to do, you know? So we go from desire, which is our innate intelligence, to fantasy, and then we fall into dark fantasy, and then if we're lucky, we find some old sack of cat food at the bottom of the closet, and we start eating the cat food. So at some point, what's normally not food becomes food. We fall into hunger, desperation. So at some point, you know, cat food becomes food. At some point, he only beats me twice a year becomes love. You see what I'm saying, you know? Yeah. Now, the fourth level is just when you give up and you become the walking dead and you go numb. So these are our choices in human desire, fantasy, hunger, numbness. And desire is warm, moist, and expansive. And creative visualization and imagination is like kind of higher level of fantasy, you know, and also looking through the eyes of wonder at all things, you see. That's the way you want to stay in that place. But most of us fall into dark fantasies, trying to predict a future that will never be a reality. It might be worse or it might be better than we ever imagined, you know? This is a good time to visualize the way you might want it too, to create a new way. So if you could create a warm, moist, beautiful fantasy of what the world's going to become right now, that's where you can put in your soul's energy into making a new reality.
Yeah.
That's our duty at this time, the way I see it.
So I agree that, yes, you have to process the fear and get your footing, but you don't have to watch news nonstop and worrying and spending all your energy on that isn't going to raise your immune system. And we have to start creating the world that we do want, for yeah. sure. So, well, this is perfect. So to tell us from you know, the states that we want to be in and how you can read the energy field to see, I know when I did a session with you, you were like talking about the colors, like you have this or that and the different patterns. Like I think I had that mother one too. And but what is karma? Because just so many different ideas about karma. And so how do you see karma? And then like, you know, the good questions your patients was asking, you know, how do I cleanse that? Or how does your work help people become aware of it and cleanse it?
There's the realization that rather than punishment, karma is really what we're doing now, but not necessarily with our physical actions, yes, that too, but with our light body, so that we're always acting from our light body, from our soul, so to speak. And most of the time we could change our external action, but we wouldn't necessarily, we can even change our attitude or our thoughts or our feelings, but we still might be acting in our light body from that fear, from that anxiousness, from that contracted state, you know? So my work began in terms of trying to figure out what is it that is, you know, so people would have like different archetypes of different karmas, like orphan or slave, like the slave guy or servant or rejected bride or unwanted wife or, you know, sexual victim or, you know, so on and so forth. There's just all these traumatic karmas that people carry. And most of the time, we're addicted to our story about what happened to us. And that addiction to that story is a sort of desperate way of trying to get meaning from that injury. It's almost like, he bit me, mommy. No, bite him back, I'm driving. No, but he bit me. You know, it's like we want the validation of our victimization. All who live have pain. But suffering at some level is a choice. Like people who give childbirth, it's painful, they say, but most people wouldn't consider it suffering. See, suffering and pain are different in a way. And suffering is more the story we tell about our pain to try to make some sense of why we're in pain. And that action in and of itself puts us into a deep rabbit hole, a third person perspective. The story about the story is not the story, you see? So, and all of that whole process is really a contraction. Karma means action. Now there are karma types, what I call karma types, like slave or orphan or servant or unwanted wife or rejected husband or a failed leader or failed son or, you know, on and on. I have lists and lists of these things. And the human condition is dispersed through many, many of these kinds of shapes and qualities. They shape our physical appearance in some cases, like outcasts usually look kind of rough and meaty, you know. Orphans can look really waif-like. Slaves look overburdened and bent, you know. It depends on nuns look nunly, monks look monkly, you know? The karma types imprint us, but the dharma types do too. Like you are a mystic and a priestess and a healer. Those are defined your life extremely strongly. Also a storyteller, you know? And those kinds of things, you see, you know? And if you think about how powerful those different dharma types that, and so the dharma types, the more we act from those dharma types, the more you become more and more of who you really are, you see.
And that, does that actually turn the volume down on the bad karma, or does it dissolve it or transform it?
Almost like we start to at some point get our head above water, and then we can dog paddle and keep ourselves from going under, and then we don't go down the dark fantasy hole anymore. So if we act from the power of our soul to create, and all beings have dharma types, you know, that are powerful parts of themselves, you know, deep parts of their soul that are begging to manifest in this life. And the more we act from that, the less fear, the less room there is to fall into despair, the less it's like the garden, you know, thing. Is the more flowers you plant, the less room there is for weeds.
Yeah.
So it's a way of thinking about it. And you know, sometimes you can imprint the light body quite quickly, but most people, it's a chore. It takes time, you know. So if you have an interest or a desire, something to learn, like one of the things that I usually ask people to help them reawaken their desire, because desire is the opposite of fear almost, you know. Love and desire and awe and wonder and curiosity are all the opposite of fear and anxiety. And so one of the things is most people have lost track of what they want. So I ask, well, what would you do if you had $50 million? Or what would you do if you had 1,000 years to live, no suicide? What would you like to master? That's a very important question. And then try to master that. Mastery, I highly recommend mastering something. Because if you master something, it sort of takes over your entire being, your entire light body. And it doesn't allow things to get you down in the same way. You know, like they can take away this, you can take away that, or you could take away this, but you still have that mastery. You know, that quality that is yours, that's your gift from the universe that makes you so unique and special and wondrous, you know. And so the more that is emanative, the less there's a tendency to fall into dark fantasies, to fall into places of feeling impoverished. Certainly self-pity is, I think, you know, could be considered the worst poverty, you know. And this world situation, people can fall into self-pity right now really easily. Mm. But if we can find a way to awaken ourselves from those kinds of drudges and stay in a place of the beauty and wonder, the stillness of the world, all of the qualities that have taken us inside our own being instead of having such an external life, that will return. At some point it will return, you know, but the inner life is where it's at. And so this is a really good time to train yourself to have the inner life.
Absolutely. So in terms of transforming the fear, how does your work, I know that you both teach people how to do this, the Naroda karma healing, or you can have a session like we did. And I remember you read the aura, you told me the different patterns and how the impact is, you know, how they relate to what you're experiencing right now, right? Like, why is this pattern or why can't I? As your awareness awakens and you're like, oh, I can't do this anymore or something, or why do I have that? I mean, I know I've felt that and I've seen that in clients, that slave pattern where you just keep working hard and never expect anything really for yourself. You don't think you deserve it and all of those things. And then that awareness, you also do something else, like a blessing or some kind of a process. And then to give us some examples or a little bit more understanding of how that fear or how that session helps us to transform this energy.
So this particular woman had, of course, a number of hungers. You know, she had the hunger, a desperate hunger to avoid losing what she had. She wanted to keep her big house, you know. She didn't want to lose her children. She didn't want to go to the funny farm or the insane asylum or whatever it is, you know. She didn't want to disrupt her life. So oftentimes people are desperate to avoid disrupting their life, to they don't want to disappoint their didn't want to disappoint her father. You know, her father said, no, don't get divorced. You won't get to take communion anymore. You know, things like that, you know. So I, you know, did the karma healing, the karma detraumatization on those traumas and cleared those hungers out of her system. And so a couple of weeks later, she called me up and said, I did it. I, you know, her husband had come home and been abusive to her son, and she had to take her son to the doctor's office because he broke his collarbone, and she called the police and she divorced him. I said, I get it. The universe is asking me to, you know, protect my children. And that's the bottom line. I'm protecting my children. So everything in her life got better, you see. And at one point I began to feel that, you know, there's more to this whole thing. So when we operate from hunger, it's like there's a hungry soul way of doing things. Like a hungry soul way of getting food would be like dumpster diving or stealing from the apple cart or begging on the streets or something. A hungry soul way of getting sex would be bar hopping or prostitution or, you know, exploitation or something like that. A hungry soul way of getting attention would be like going nude in the mall or something. You know, a hungry soul way of getting money would be robbing banks or scamming or, you know, and so hungry soul things don't take you anywhere. They don't really satisfy, you know, when you can find somebody to have sex with, but when the sex is over, the hunger's over. It's not based on desire. Everything has to be legitimately based on desire. And so I realized that a lot of us have, almost everyone has some parts of themselves that are really hungry. So my work detraumatizes the causes of those hungers in our light body. And that lifts you out of that. Now there's a secondary stage, which I call free soul. And free soul is, you're not a victim anymore. I can take care of myself. You know, I'm not gonna do what you say. I'm not gonna get married and have your babies. I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna work for an asshole. I mean, you know, things like that. You see what I'm saying? So free soul food is, you know, I collected a whole bunch of bottles, mom. I trade them in, I got a big bag of rice. I'll be home for Christmas or Hanukkah. You know, it's like I take care of myself, a certain sense of independence, you know. So that's a better stage, but still life isn't as meaningful. It's kind of like getting by. It's like subsistence. Naked soul is this state, incredible state, where the universe starts to become your partner, your friend. You're walking down the street saying, wow, I'm hungry, and your old friend Susie pulls over and said, come on over. I've been cooking all afternoon, all your favorite food. By the way, my brother is in town. He's always had the hot spot. You know, so it's like, you know, it's like, you know, your whole life unfolds. If a new opportunity happens, the universe. So in Sufism, we call that one-handed basket weaving. You weave with one hand, the universe weaves with the other. And so it's a kind of like an interdependent, more, your life is more featured. There's less struggle. You strive without struggling. So my work is to end enough bad karmas to where that whole thing tips over. Now, sometimes that happens really quickly for people. So you'd already done a lot of work on yourself, so it didn't take as much on you, and you were already, you know, kind of almost naked soul already in some respects, you know. But things have really gone much further than now, you see. So if you smooth out the light body, then it starts to emanate a lot more clarity. You become more psychic, you know. You're not caught up in dark psychic fantasies and things, you know. You're not living in the gutter in a psychic way like some people do, and you know, you're the integrity of your aura is much stronger, and you're able to increase your radiance. And that radiance prevents you from being attacked, prevents you from being consumed by negativity of others. You know, the brighter your light body is, the more you can tolerate adversity without succumbing to it, you see. Mm-hmm.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
That's a really big one.
like there's different ways that people set boundaries, you know, something like you move to the next door neighbor and his dog comes over and poops on your lawn, so you put up a fence, and then you like him and he's got a dog too, and you got a dog too, and you're leaving town, so he's going to watch your dog, and then maybe you put up a gate, and then maybe 5 years later you tear this fence down because you can trust each other, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
But another way to create a boundary is by increasing your radiance. And that's a way of illumination. And the stronger your radiance, if people get too close, they get burned, you know. But then, you know, it's a bright light, you know, attracts a lot of connection. And a lot of radiance is, you know, definitely a defense against the darkness of the world.
So how can somebody get over the fear enough, transform the fear enough, to get to those warm, moist, nice states? Because that's, of course, where we let go and transcend all the worry and, you know, negative thinking. And when you're there, it's so much easier to think positive or to say, this too shall pass, it'll be okay, and not get caught up in it. And yet a lot of people, you know, I'm very blessed. I live with one person. They're on the same wavelength. We don't, you know, they're not fighting me in terms of wanting to watch the news or horror shows or, you know, like the energy, we have a flow. But a lot of people right now are inundated by their family or other people's energies, and they're sometimes every day in their life are shut in. And so that you get there in a meditation, and then you feel pulled back down. Then you go into guilt or judgment, right? About, and you get back up. So do you have some tips on how to do that?
Yes. I mean, you know, basically, if you really awaken your light body so it has enough of its own resilience, then the nature of the heart, the nature of your love. And I think our individual egos aren't built really strong enough to tolerate the pain and suffering of the world, you know? So usually the way I started the training with this is to spend a lot of time feeling connected to deity, that somehow deity had that power, and then somehow that deity power came implanted in my own heart, you know? And I call it, in Sufism, it's called Mushahida, which is the great witnessing. So, and this witnessing is the kind, it's very much like Ho'oponopono, you know, which you're probably familiar with, you know. And it's extremely similar to Ho'oponopono. And it's that so watching bad TV doesn't bother me because the images that come before me are transformed by the light of my own being, you see? It's just like if Jesus and Buddha fixed you breakfast every morning, you know, and said, well, we just wanted to show up here for you and cook you a little breakfast and say, you know, we want you to have a good day, and we wanted to hug you and give you our strength and our blessing and our love, and you know, just going to tell you it's going to be all right, and even when everything falls apart here, we're going to catch you and hold you for all eternity. Okay.
Yeah, I like that. I want to sign up for that.
Yeah. You see, but that is the way it is, really. That is the reality. So you have to come to a realization in your heart that that is the reality. That if there's any way that Jesus or Buddha or any other great saints really could do that, that they're doing it in some way, you know? So if you can connect to that stream of guidance, the masters, saints, and prophets, and you can live in the divine protection, but more really the divine compassion and love and mercy of that place, then, you know, everything that happens here changes. It's people often say that life is a school and we have to learn all these lessons. I dispute that somewhat. I believe that life is an unfolding adventure in beingness and becomingness, that we're supposed to take up the, you know, the cross of time and space and allow ourselves to come fully into what it means to be a human being and to suffer all the ups and downs and things like that, but to somehow still, you know, rise to a place of more and more depth of being, and that our awakening can help God awaken and everyone awaken, you know, in a sense. Mm-hmm. That's
it. I love that. I love that. What a perfect place to end. So you've got a gift for us. It's a video, right? And it's about that hungry soul.
A hungry soul, free soul, naked soul. And yeah. I'll send it to you and you can transfer it to the people. And it's just a little talk, a little understanding of how you can change your life and move out of a place of desperation to beyond just a place of independent well-being to a place of being deeply interdependent with the universe and with all that is in this extraordinary journey. And a lot of spiritual paths have to do with kind of ending the false self, you know? And I understand that. But once an old man, he said, to be a Sufi is to prove you're alive. I like that.
Yeah, to be here.
How are you going to prove you're alive in the time of COVID? How are you going to prove you're alive in this most remarkable of times, you know?
Yeah, and what are you contributing? Because, you know, we're talking about all of these things, experiences and thoughts and memories and past lives that affect your reality right now. Right. And in this moment, you have some extra time, maybe at home. You've got a time to decide to master something, like you said. I love that. To focus on lightening your light body and transforming the fear by consciously recognizing when you're going into the what ifs, you know, to the worry, to the dark fantasies, and into those. And to notice how often or how much of the day you're spending in those particular states, because like ingredients that you cook with, right? If you put a bunch of dirty old moldy stuff in with brand new fresh stuff, it's still going to come out pretty nasty. those energies. So that's fantastic. Tell us your website and how people can find out more about both working with you or learning how to do this as well.
Sure. The easy one is just to go to karmadoctor.com. And because that's when it's karma and doctor are spelled out .com, and that'll take you into the Naroda Karma Healing website.
Perfect.
And if you sign up there and you ask for information, I train people to become karma doctors, but you know, mostly I've done these sessions and now I've just decided I wanted to train people. And, you know, so I now have classes in learning how to become a karma healer and then eventually a karma doctor. It's not an easy thing, but it's also an extraordinary journey with a group of extraordinary people. So,
yeah. And what I found, I think one of the reasons that I kept learning more and more modalities and paths, and it was that it's a personal journey. That's part of your healing. And you do it with yourself first, right? And then you get to where you can help other people because you've gone through it, your personal experience.
It's all about experiences and experiencing your own awakening, experiencing your own transformation. And then you can catalyze other people's states. And, you know, it's you know, you have to teach yourself how to climb out of the ditch before you can really, you know, help others, you know.
Exactly. So, yes.
It's an important maturing, you know. It's not always easy, but you know, if you stay in a place of awe and wonder, curiosity, you know, and just remember it's the awe, not the fear.
You know? Yeah.
It's that vastness, the extraordinary vastness of existence, you know.
Yeah. I do think that we often misinterpret emotions as fear. I know that I've worked with clients or students that have gotten to the point where their old patterns might come back as an echo, you know, and they'll be like, why do I still feel fear? And I've tuned in and said, I'm not sure it's fear anymore, but I don't think that you can tell the difference. right? I think that, you know, we get trained to be afraid. Don't do this too fast. Don't be spontaneous. Don't trust, you know, and all these things. Whereas sometimes that's power, excitement, like you call it, desire. And will you be a little nervous doing something you don't know or going into the unknown? Sure. But it's just like speaking. I used to not be able to speak at all, ever, in front of anybody, even one person. And through different things, I'd still go on the stage right now in front of 5,000 people with no hesitation. And yet there would be an up-leveling of energy, right? That would be like, get present, get ready, be here. That in the past, I might have interpreted as fear.
A lot of people have excitement and anxiety merged. They can't tell the difference.
There you
and
go.
Also, you know, relaxation and exhaustion are merged for some people, you see. Right. So those two things are really separate things, but they may feel the same until you can feel into the nature of excitement. And excitement can be very warm. It's expansive. You're going to get out there in front of the people and you're going to expand into the people there in a state of wonder and expansion.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly. Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you so much. It's so wonderful. There you are in Morocco. And we can still do this. It's amazing. I love how we've got light like you around the world, different places. Thank you for your work and for your help that you've given us. And thank you for being willing to share and teach this so we can get more people that are able to do this karma healing. So I appreciate you so much.
Thank you so much, Nan. It's really great to see you again. I appreciated all your astute connectedness and everything you said. So best with all the people who are, you know, and that we all get through this together. And thanks for the opportunity. So
absolutely. So karmadoctor.com. Thank you so much. Blessings, everybody. Please share this. Remember that it's free forever and you can come back anytime you want. And make sure that you get this wonderful video that John is sharing about going from being a hungry soul to a free soul to a naked soul. I love it. I'm going to get mine too. All right. Thanks, everyone. Have a beautiful and blessed day.
You too. Bye-bye, Nan. Thank you very much.